Good evening and welcome to our Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program brought to you from Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto. My name is Denise Carter. It is my pleasure to introduce David Brooks, New York Times op-ed columnist and author of The Social Animal, A Story of Love, Character, and Achievement. David's extensive journalism career started at Chicago's City News Bureau. He joined the Wall Street Journal as editor of the book review section and later served as interim movie critic, foreign correspondent in Brussels, covering Russia, the Middle East, South Africa, and European affairs, and as the op-ed editor. In 1995, David joined the Weekly Standard as their senior editor and also served as contributing editor at Newsweek and at the Atlantic Monthly. Since 2003, his insightful and compelling political and cultural commentary has appeared in the New York Times. A regular commentator on PBS's The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer and frequent analyst on NPR's All Things Considered, David is the best-selling author of several books, including Bobos in Paradise, The New Upper Class and How They Got There, and On Paradise Drive, How We Live Now and Always Have in the Future Tense. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming David Brooks.
Good to be here. I get a hammer. This is excellent. It's great to be at the JCC. I used to live in East Palo Alto. We didn't have this fabulous building the way we do now. And it's a sort of an odd road for me to be at a JCC. I've had several changes in my life. I started out as more or less a left-wing secular person as a kid. I grew up in New York City in Greenwich Village. And I was somewhat left-wing as a kid. My parents took me to a be-in when I was five. Be-in was where hippies would go just to be. And one of the things they did as part of their being is they set a garbage can on fire and threw their wallets into it to demonstrate their liberation from money and material things. And I was five, and I saw a $5 bill on fire there. And I ran up and grabbed it and ran away. And that was my first step over to the right. I was also, we were pretty secular. We're a Jewish family, but pretty secular. I went to Grace Church School in Lower Manhattan. I was part of the all-Jewish boys davening choir at Grace. But then at college, I went to the University of Chicago, where fun goes to die. And the other saying about Chicago is it's a Baptist school where atheist professors teach Jewish students St. Thomas Aquinas. And I was one of those Jewish students, but I was not particularly religious. But then I married a woman who was Protestant at the time. 3 years after we were married, she converted to Judaism, and then she announced she wanted to study for the rabbinate. She wanted to, we now keep a kosher home. We send our kids to Jewish day school. We lead a quite religiously Jewish life. And my line is this, how we know God exists, because only he would go so far out of his way to screw me this badly to get me back in. So it's a pleasure for me to be at the JCC building. My wife finds these events hilarious that I'm speaking at. It is a pleasure, I find myself in the odd position of talking about emotion, and I'm going to talk to you about emotion, but I got into it through a backward way. I cover politics in my day job, and I was given a good piece of advice when I took my current job, which was to interview three politicians every day. And from that close contact, I can tell you they're all emotional freaks of one sort or another. They have what I call logorrhea dementia, which is they talk so much they drive themselves insane. But what politicians do have in general is incredible social skills. And so when you meet them, they will come right up to you. They'll invade your personal space. They'll rub the back of your head, caress your lapels. I talk about a Republican senator who I had dinner with who had his hand on my thigh the whole meal, sort of just squeezing it. Years ago, I was in the well of the Senate. I saw Ted Kennedy meeting Dan Quayle down there. I was up in the press gallery. They were in the well, and they gave each other a big hug, and they were laughing, and their faces were like this far apart, and they were hugging and moving, and their arms were rubbing up and down each other's backs, and they were sort of grinding away down there. And I was like, get a room. I don't want to see this. And so they have just incredible abilities. Mitt Romney, I was covering him in New Hampshire last election cycle, and he was up there campaigning with his four perfect sons, Bip, Chip, Rip, Sip, and Lip, Dip, and Lip. And he was going into a diner, and he goes into this diner, and he starts talking, introducing himself to each family at the diner, asking what village in New Hampshire are you from, and then describing the home he owned in their village. And he would go around from one table to the other, and then he meets about 40 people, and he first names almost everybody he's just met. And so I was thinking that is social skills. And then just finally, I was at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, where I live, and a neuroscientist showed me a video of a young girl who was 18 months old, but she suffered from Williams syndrome. And from the outside, Williams syndrome looks like sort of like reverse autism. So kids with Williams syndrome have only interest in social engagement. So in the video she showed me, she's in the room with a 12-year-old boy who's juggling, who's knocking over stuff, and she has no interest in the physical blocks or anything like that. She just wants to stare into his eyes, get real close to him and just stare into his eyes to get that social contact. And I'm looking at this video and I'm thinking, this is every senator I've ever covered. And so that's what they have, this incredible ability to read moods and reflect it back to people. And yet in their public roles, that subtlety and that social awareness suddenly disappears. And so when they're campaigning, sometimes it's just crude displays of artificial emotion. And then when they're governing, often they take this dehumanized view of human nature, which totally eliminates the social aspects. And so over the course of my career, I've covered a series of policy failures, all of which I think derive from this false view of human nature, a very shallow and a very materialistic view of human nature. I covered the decline of the Soviet Union, the rise of Russia. And in those days, we sent economists with privatization plans and hard currency plans into Russia. But we were oblivious to the fact that what Russia really lacked was social trust. And without that trust, everyone was going to steal everything. And the hard currency plans didn't really matter. In Iraq, famously, we sent in the military, but I think we were oblivious to the cultural and psychological realities of Iraq. We had a financial regulatory system based on the idea that bankers were prudent, rational, self-interested creatures who wouldn't do anything stupid en masse. And that turned out not to be true. And the issue that I actually care about most is education. And I've covered education since the Nation at Risk report in 1983. And we've spent much of those decades rearranging bureaucratic boxes, big schools, small schools, charter schools, vouchers, a whole series of reforms that produced disappointing results because they skirted the core issue, which is the individual relationship between a teacher and a student. And the reality is people learn from people they love. But if you mention the word love at a congressional hearing, they look at you like you're Oprah. They do not want to talk in those terms. And so I was confronted with the paradox that the most socially attuned people on earth, when it comes to policymaking, often take a completely dehumanized Congressional Budget Office view of human nature. And so the question is, why does that happen? And I came to the conclusion that it comes from a wider cultural problem, that for centuries we've inherited a view of that we're divided creatures. We have reason over here and emotion over here. And if anything, they're like on a seesaw, that if reason is up, then emotion is down. And if your emotion is up, then your reason is down. And that society progresses to the extent that rationalism can dominate the passions. And this view of human nature has created a view of who we are, that we're rational individuals who respond in straightforward ways to incentives. That's more or less the classical economic view of human beings. It's led to ways of seeing the world. We now have academic disciplines that try to use the methodologies of physics to explain human behavior. They value the things that they can count and put into computer models and sort of amputate all the rest. And this great amputation has emphasized rationalism and reason and de-emphasized and almost neglected some of the things that are happening deep down below. And it's meant, I think, culturally that we're really good at talking about material things, but bad at talking about emotions. We're good at talking about skills and safety, but when it comes to things like character, we often have nothing to say. And you can see it in the way we raise our kids. We're here in Palo Alto, and if you go to the local schools here, even local public schools, you can see the third graders coming out of the public schools with their 80-pound backpacks. If the wind blows them over, they're like little beetles stuck on the ground. They can't get out. And if you go to the elementary schools at 3 p.m, you see the cars coming to pick up the kids. It's usually Saabs and Audis and Volvos because in towns like this one, it's socially acceptable to have a luxury car so long as it comes from a country hostile to U.S. foreign policy. That's fine. And there are certain creatures I've written about that come to pick up the kids. I call them Uber moms, who are highly successful career women who've taken time off to make sure all their kids can get into Stanford. And you can usually tell the Uber moms because they actually weigh less than their own children. Sort of at the moment of conception, they're doing little butt exercises. During pregnancy, they're taking so many soy-based nutritional formulas that the babies come out these 13-pound behemoths. They look like sort of toothless defensive linemen plopping out there. The Uber moms are cutting the umbilical cord themselves, flashing Mandarin flashcards at the things to get them ready to learn Chinese and get ready. And then they go off to become the junior workaholics of America, competing with all the other tiger moms. And this may not be a style of child rearing that we like, but we're sort of trapped into it. We ridicule it, but we don't renounce it because we have this meritocratic system that really emphasizes the hard skills and doesn't emphasize some of the softer, more moral skills. And when we do try to talk about morality and things like that, often we end up just talking about shopping, and we try to fulfill some moral urges through our consumption. And so I wrote a book about, Whole Foods, supermarkets, and Ben & Jerry's, ice cream company with its own foreign policy. I joked in one of those books that Ben & Jerry's should make a pacifist toothpaste, doesn't kill germs, just ask them to leave. That would be a big seller. And then sort of the Whole Foods and the Trader Joe's are the sort of morally uplifting grocery stores where all the cashiers look like they're on loan from Amnesty International. What we buy in my household, we buy these seaweed-based organic snacks, one called Veggie Booty with kale, which is for kids who come home and say, "Mom, Mom, I want a snack that'll help prevent colon rectal cancer." And so these are all sort of products of this amputation, emphasis on skills, emphasis on materialism, but sort of vagueness and maybe insufficiency when it comes to the deeper things. And so I've been sort of wrestling with these issues, both in policy terms, but also in personal and spiritual terms. And while I'm wrestling with this, what I think this bias in our culture, over in a different sphere, I found people who are helping solve a lot of these problems, helping see a deeper and really articulate a deeper version of human nature. And the odd thing was that a lot of people really looking deep into human nature these days and trying to decode it are not in fields like theology and philosophy, or at least not exclusively in those fields, but they're among the fields that study the human mind. Fields like neuroscience, cognitive science, psychology, sociology, behavioral economics. And these fields are making incredible progress in really peering into the inner reaches of the mind, of how the brain works, and really producing, or not producing new ways of seeing ourselves, but reminding us of some old ways and reconfirming some old ways. And the exciting thing is, though they use the language of science and they use sophisticated technology like fMRI machines, they're not producing a cold, mechanistic view of human nature. They're producing sort of an enchanted and very humanistic view of human nature. And I think if you take these various fields, they cohere around a couple key insights. The first insight is that while the conscious mind writes the autobiography of our species, most of our thinking and most of our most impressive thinking is unconscious, and that the central arena of life is below the level of awareness. So one way to illustrate this is the fact, or the, it's just as an illustration, that the human mind can take in roughly 12 million pieces of information per minute, of which we can be consciously aware of 40. And all the rest is being processed unconsciously. And this leads to some peculiarities. One of the bits of research I found was done by a guy at the University of Buffalo. He found that people named Dennis are disproportionately likely to become dentists. People named Lawrence are disproportionately likely to become lawyers because unconsciously we gravitate toward things that are familiar. And my joke is this is why I've named my daughter President of the United States Brooks in order to steer her. But these are things, some are odd, but some are profound. How we learn to relate to each other, how we learn to perceive the world. Perception is not just a simple process of taking things in. Perceiving the world is an act of creation. And most of the way we organize our vision of the world is done unconsciously. And many of these processes are phenomenally smart. So if you have trouble making up your mind on a crucial issue, say a decision between two alternatives, one of the things you can do is flip a coin and tell yourself, I'll go with whatever the coin says. But when the coin lands, don't go with what the coin says. Go with your emotional reaction to the coin flip. Are you happy or sad it came up heads or tails? And that's a way of your inner mind, which has already made up its mind, telling you what it thinks. And so the first insight is the power of these unconscious processes. The second insight is that emotion is not separate from reason, but emotion is the foundation from reason. There's a scientist at USC named Antonio Damasio who has done pioneering work here, studying people who suffered strokes and have had lesions so they can't actually process emotion. And these people are not super smart, they're super dumb. Because what emotion does, it tells us what we value. Emotion is the valuation system. And so when you see something, somebody doing something heroic, you feel a surge of admiration. When you see cruelty, you feel a surge of disgust or contempt or anger. Emotions tell you what you want, what you don't want, where to go, where you shouldn't go, like sort of a GPS system advising you this way or that way. And so emotion is the foundation of reason. And when you educate your emotions, when you elevate your emotions, you don't lead to dumber decisions, lead to smarter decisions. Now, I'm a middle-aged guy, and I'm not particularly comfortable talking about emotions. My wife's joke is that me writing a book about emotion is like Gandhi writing a book about gluttony. It's not the natural thing. There's a great story of a brain research, which is apocryphal, but gets at a core truth. They took a bunch of middle-aged guys, stuck them in these fMRI machines, had them watch a horror movie, and then had them describe their feelings toward their wives. And the brain scans were the same during both activities, just sheer terror in both circumstances. And I sort of know what that feels like. Nonetheless, emotion not only organizes how we see the world, it tells us what to remember, it tells us what to encode, and it literally builds the material connections in the mind. In 1945, there was a scientist named Renee Spitz who studied an orphanage in this country, and the theory behind this orphanage was that the way to keep kids healthy was to keep it germ-free, antiseptic. So the kids were fed, they were given medical care, but they were not handled. And by age two, the orphans in this orphanage had a mortality rate of 37%. And they stopped naming the kids because they were dying at such high rates. And it is the love between a parent and a child that literally rewires and wires the brain. And so emotion really is at the center of how we think. And there's been this revolution. So Damasio says that in 1995 at the big neuroscience conventions, there were no panels on emotion. And now it is probably the dominant or a dominant subject. And so we're beginning to appreciate the power of emotion. The third insight is that we're not primarily self-contained individuals, but we're social animals who are deeply interpenetrated one with another. We're not individuals who form contracts and form relationships. The relationships come first, and we emerge out of those relationships. And so we have these things they call the mirror neurons, somewhat controversial concept. But when we look at each other, we don't only see each other, we reenact in our own minds what we observe in others. When we see someone in pain, we reenact that pain in our own minds. When I see a movie with a car chase, my brain acts as if it's in a car chase. When I see you pick up a glass, I'm not only reenacting the action of picking up a glass, I'm judging the intention behind the action. So picking up a glass to drink produces a different reaction than picking up the glass to put it in a dishwasher. And this act of judgment and evaluation and observation are all the same action. And we communicate with each other in these deep interpenetrated ways in many different forms. Most powerfully in smell. You would think that you'd rather lose your vision. I mean, most people, if given the choice between losing vision and losing smell, would say, I'd rather lose my sense of smell because vision seems so central to how we deal with the world. But in fact, the people who've lost their sense of smell suffer greater emotional deterioration because though we're not aware of it, a lot of what's happening between ourselves is through sense of smell. There was a piece of research done in Germany where they took took gauze pads, taped them under people's arms, and then had some people watch a horror movie and some people watch a comedy. And then they got other research subjects who were presumably well-paid, and they had them sniff the gauze pads. And they said, which movie was this person wearing? And people could tell way above chance simply by sniffing the gauze pad. And women, by the way, were much better at this than men. And so these three insights in this whole fields of research, I think, gives us a different story of how life works. In some sense, in the amputated version of who we are and really the prevailing culture, we're children of the French Enlightenment, of Descartes, of people who said that reason is the most admirable and most powerful of our faculties and that we should clear the way of emotion and let reason dominate. But there was a different Enlightenment, the Scottish or British Enlightenment, led by people like David Hume and Adam Smith and Edmund Burke, who said that reason is weak, the sentiments are strong. And often the sentiments are trustworthy. And I think this research confirms or really fortifies the Scottish Enlightenment's view of human nature and casts into doubt the French Enlightenment's view of human nature and gives us a different sense of who we are. And this different sense of who we are stretches across a range of many different fields. And it gives us a sense of human capital, of what it takes to lead a fulfilled life. And when we think about human capital, often we think about grades, SAT scores, professional degrees, years in school. But this research really illuminates a whole set of different skills, which are both emotional and rational at the same time. And these include things like, the first one is mindsight, the ability to enter into another person's mind and learn from what they have to offer you. Babies come with this skill. Alan Meltzoff, a scientist at the University of Washington in about 1979, leaned over a baby who was 43 minutes old, and he wagged his tongue at the baby, and she wagged her tongue back. And so even at 43 minutes, we're born to mimic each other and in that way to share the models that we have in each other's heads. Babies are phenomenally good at reading faces. If you take a six-month-old baby and show it a series of monkey faces, a six-month-old can distinguish one monkey from the other. We tend to have lost that skill by adulthood because we're less good at reading each other. Now, in this country, about 55% of the infants establish that kind of two-way communication with mom and dad, and they are what they call securely attached. And they come early in life with the ability not only to read mom and dad, but a model of how to enter into other relationships and learn from other people. And this is tremendously useful to them when they go to school because they know how to learn and relate to teacher. And scientists at the University of Minnesota can study what they call attachment patterns at age 18 months and predict with 77% accuracy who's going to graduate from high school because some kids have these ability to form attachments with mom, with dad, with teachers, and with adults, and with friends, and they have a leg up. About 20% of the kids in this country have what they call avoidant attachments. They send signals out, but nothing's come back for whatever reason. And these kids have trouble relating to teacher. One of the teachers in one of the books I read described an avoidantly attached kid tacking into the wind, trying to get close to teacher but not knowing how to do it. And avoidantly attached kids later in life have much less activation of the reward areas of their brains during social interaction. They get less of a kick out of friendship. And by age 70, they're going to have many fewer friends on average than others. Now, nothing that happens in the first 18 months is going to seal a person's fate, but it opens up a pathway which can either be confirmed or not confirmed by later experience. And so some people have this ability to enter into relationships and just hoover up information from each other. The second trait is what you might call equipoise, which is the ability to have the serenity and maturity to monitor your own biases and correct for your own shortcomings of the unconscious mind, what the scientists call metacognition. And so, for example, we're all overconfidence machines. 95% of college professors believe they have above-average teaching skills. 96% of college students have above-average leadership skills. Time magazine asked people, are you in the top 1% of earners? And 19% of Americans are in the top 1% of earners. Since we're in Silicon Valley, I'll mention that Paul Schumacher and Edward Russo, two researchers, gave tests to executives in different industries. And the tests were about their own industries. And they asked the people they studied to answer questions and then to evaluate how confident they were that they got the answers right. So people in the advertising industry said they were 90% sure they got the answers correct. In fact, they got 60% wrong. The industry with the highest overconfidence rates were people in the software and computer industry. They thought they got the answers 95% correct. In fact, they got them 80% wrong. This is a strongly gender-linked trait, by the way. Men drown at twice the rate as women because men have incredible confidence in their swimming abilities, especially after they've been drinking. But some people have the ability to monitor these biases, and they have a set of mental character traits which are different from IQ. So they're open-minded in the face of ambiguity. They adjust the strength of their conclusion to the strength of the evidence. They're modest in the face of partial knowledge. And they build modesty bootstraps for themselves because they know they're likely to be overconfident. And so, for example, Peter Drucker had a great one where he said, when you make a decision, write your decision down and your reasoning, seal it in an envelope, and open it in 9 months. And you'll see that a third of your decisions were right, a third were wrong, a third were in the middle. But in almost all cases, your reasoning will be completely irrelevant. And this is the way you remind yourself of your own weakness as a thinker. The third trait is a Greek word called metis, which is the ability to see a complicated landscape and pick out the essential patterns. My newspaper did a great story of some soldiers in Iraq who could look down streets after many months of service and tell whether there was an IED, a landmine, planted in that street. And when you asked them to do that, you would say, how do you know? And they'd say, I couldn't really tell you, but I feel a coldness inside. And unconsciously, they can perceive that something is amiss, though they couldn't tell you why that is. And some people have these perceptual skills. A related one is what you might call sympathy, the ability to read other people and to detect the fine variations in what they're thinking and what they're feeling. And this helps in the ability to work in groups. Now, groups are generally smarter than individuals, and groups that meet face-to-face are much smarter than groups that communicate electronically. At the University of Michigan, they did a study where they took groups and gave them math tests. Some groups met face-to-face, and they were given 10 minutes to solve the math problems, and they did very well. Other groups met and communicated by email, and were given 30 minutes to solve the math problems, and these groups could not solve the problems. They broke up. And that's because most of our communication is nonverbal. It's face-to-face. And the groups that do very well, the group IQ is not shaped by the IQ of the individual members. It has to do with how well the members of any particular group are attuned to each other. How often do they take turns in conversation? How often do they read each other's signals? And so these are the abilities that some people have to work well in groups and read each other's signals. The fifth trait I'll mention is what you might call propriety, the ability to see the world in ways and to develop habits to maximize character and self-restraint. My favorite experiment in all these fields of research, and probably the most famous experiment in all these fields of research, was done by a guy named Walter Mischel, who was here at Stanford and then went to Columbia, and it's called the Marshmallow Experiment, and many of you probably know it, but just very quickly, Mischel took marshmallows, put them in a room, and put four-year-olds in the room, put the marshmallow on the table in front of them, and said, you can eat this marshmallow now, but I'm going to come back in 10 minutes, and if you haven't eaten the marshmallow, I'll give you two marshmallows. And Michelle showed me videos of the kids trying not to eat the marshmallow. These videos are online, and there's a little girl banging her head on the table trying not to eat the marshmallow. One little guy, Michelle was using an Oreo cookie, little guy picks up the Oreo, carefully eats out the middle and carefully puts it back on the table. And that kid is now a U.S. senator. But the important thing is that the kids who could wait 10, 12, 15 minutes, 20 years later have much higher college completion rates, and 30 years later much higher incomes. A lot of the kids just pop the marshmallow right in their mouth. And those kids 20 years later have much higher drug and alcohol addiction problems and much, much higher incarceration rates. And that's because even by age 4, some kids have grown up in homes where actions lead to consequences and they've developed strategies to control their impulses. And if you can do that, school will be okay. If you can't do that, school will be frustrating and your life chances are hurt. And what the kids do is they learn to pretend the marshmallow is something else. They pretend the marshmallow is a cloud. They pretend they put a frame around the marshmallow so it looks like a picture of a marshmallow. They learn ways to see the marshmallow differently, and that helps them control their impulses. And so these are all traits that are not quite IQ, not quite emotion, but a mixture of the two. But in real life actually lead to success. And the final trait I'll mention is what I call limerence, which is a word I've borrowed and sort of twisted. Not really an ability, but a motivation, a drive. And what the conscious mind hungers for is money, success, and prestige, all the things that get talked about in the magazines. But what the unconscious mind hungers for is for those moments of transcendence when consciousness of self falls away, when the skull line falls away, and we're sort of lost in something larger than ourselves. And this sense of being lost is what a craftsman or a carpenter feels when lost in a very challenging job, what a naturalist feels when lost in nature, what a religious believer feels when lost or enveloped in God's love, and what people often feel when they're in love with one another. And now this decision to fall in love is like so many of the decisions in life. Most of it happens unconsciously. We don't really choose our lovers. Love just wells up in us. And it is in some ways a very practical thing and in some ways a very romantic thing. Practically, there's real logic to our decisions, our romantic decisions. People tend to marry people with similar nose widths to their own, with eyes similarly apart. We tend to marry people with complementary immune systems, which we can tell by tasting saliva and by smell. We tend to marry people with as much status as we can get. And unfortunately, women, for men, it tends to mean marrying women with a 0.7 waist-to-hip ratio, which is universal across cultures and across times. For women, they tend to like to marry people taller than themselves, unfortunately. But it turns out, I saw one bit of research that a guy on these online dating sites, a guy who's 5'6" can get as many date offers as a guy who's 6 foot from women, so long as he makes $172,000 a year more. So got to make a lot of money to compensate for those inches. People are not making these evaluations consciously, but there's a practicality to them. To marry someone like yourself is a smart thing to do. But then there's a romance to it, an enchantment to it. Stendhal had a great line, which is he talked about crystallization. And he described Austrian miners who would throw branches from a tree into a salt mine. And then they'd come back weeks later, and they'd hold up the branches, and the crystals would have formed around them, and they would be these beautiful shimmering crystals around these tree branches. And Stendhal says that's what we do when we perceive our beloved. We put crystals around them so they're more beautiful and more loving and more glorious than they probably actually are. But this is sort of the enchanted process which keeps us married and really connected one to another. And so this is the process we yearn for, to lose ourselves in the mind of another, in the mind of a task. And really this is what many of us chase and scholars chase, those moments of epiphany when some insight comes up from down below and suddenly we're struck by this eureka moment and we lose ourselves in the challenge of what we're doing. And one of the passages I came across, which really encapsulates a lot of the things I've been talking about, the power of emotion, the wisdom of emotion, the power of unconscious processes, and the way we're all interlooped one to another, was in a book I came across by an Indiana University scientist named Douglas Hofstetter, who studies the brain. And his book was called I Am a Strange Loop. Hofstetter had written a series of very important books. And in this one, he describes in the middle of it a very personal passage. He describes his wife, Carol, and they took a sabbatical together when their kids were 5 and 2. And very suddenly, when their kids were that young age, Carol suffered a stroke and died. And Hofstadter was on sabbatical, and he had a picture of Carol months later on the bureau of his in his bedroom, just so he could see her. And one day he was just walking through the bedroom, and he happened to glance over at the picture of Carol, which he kept there. And here's what he wrote about that experience. I looked at her face, and I looked so deeply that I felt I was behind her eyes. And all at once I found myself saying, as tears flowed, "That's me, that's me." And those simple words brought back many thoughts that I had had before, about the fusion of our souls into one higher level entity, about the fact that at the core of both our souls lay our identical hopes and dreams for our children, about the notion that those hopes were not separate or distinct hopes, but were just one hope, one clear thing that defined us both, that welded us into a unit, the kind of unit I had but dimly imagined before being married and having children. I realized that though Carol had died, that core piece of her had not died at all, but that it had lived on very determinedly in my brain. Now, the Greeks used to say we suffer our way to wisdom, and through the loss of Carol, Hofstadter suffered his way to the wisdom, which he confirms as a scientist every day, that in our minds there are shared loops and that we're permeated by these loops which connect us very profoundly one to another. And in a shallower way, I think we've suffered our way to the wisdom through a series of policy failures, that any view of human nature that just takes the surface of human nature, that ignores these shared loops, ignores this underwater realm, will be condemned to failure because it will have a too shallow view of who we are. And so the exciting thing about this moment is, through these unlikely fields of neuroscience, cognitive science, and all these sciences, we're really re-enchanting and rehumanizing our view of who we are. And when Freud had his revelations about the unconscious, it had a pervasive effect on our culture. And I think as this research, which appears in the newspaper every day, is being done in thousands of different ways, permeates our culture, I think it'll have a rehumanizing effect on our culture, on the way we look at ourselves, on our moral discourse, and maybe even in our politics, to give us a deeper, more accurate view of who we are and lead to greater solutions and really a re-enchantment and a rehumanization of how we see ourselves. So thank you very much.
I'm Kirk Hansen, Executive Director of the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University, and it's my privilege to ask the questions of David Brooks this evening, raised by you. We already have many too many for the time allotted, and I apologize for that, but I'll do my best to get as many in as possible. David, I think we'll talk first about the book and then get to some of the broader political questions that inevitably must be raised with you wherever you speak.
I'm ready for Sarah Palin in any way you present.
The first is really what you hope to be the effect of the book. What kind of lessons do you hope we individually take about our own humanity? How are we to act differently? And then, because you've emphasized that that there are public policy failures because of a lack of understanding, what do you expect to be done differently in public policy?
Well, some of the things are stupid and handy. For example, if you're dating someone, it's a good idea to startle them, sneak up behind them, and yell "boo," because you can tell a lot about a person's underlying temperament from their startle response. And if they get really angry, you should be wary. If they laugh it off, that's a good sign. You should marry that person. But I guess most fundamentally, and the thing it's done for me in the years I've been working on this book, it's given me awareness that everything I write, every column I write, every interpersonal relationship I have of this underwater realm and all of the things that are happening there. So I'm still not the most touchy-feely guy on the face of the earth, but I think I do see whether it's the emotional contagion sweeping through the Middle East or whether it's a personal thing or whether it's looking at the president or anything else. I see this emotional and psychological realm first, and the realm of interests and ideas and economics I see second. And I just think that's a richer way. And then, you know, about the issue I care most about education, I think it emphasizes that while teaching math and reading are important, and assessments and testing are important, a lot of the stuff we think are squishy and peripheral are actually practical and central. And so, that's quickly things like music and arts education, which unfortunately gets cut, but educating your emotion is really the key to wisdom. And I ran to an educator in Sacramento just a couple weeks ago, and he said the things that keeps my kids in schools are the ABCs, athletics, band, and cheerleading. And that stuff is not peripheral, that's central.
Question, a couple of people asked about determinism versus choice and the shaping of character. What does determine who we are as adults? Is it our own choices? Is it our parents' choices or our educators' choices? Or is it all determined?
Well, we have many things which shape who we are. Some of it is genetic. Some of it is historical. Some of it is cultural. For example, I saw some research where they looked at people having coffee with one another, and they measured how often they touched each other. And I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but you'll get the ratios. In Rio, I think the people having coffee touched each other about 180 times an hour. In Paris, it was about 120 times an hour. In London, it was zero times an hour. So culture matters. Our education matters. The institutions we inhabit matters. So all these things contribute to who we are. But I still do think, and there's great diversity in the scientific fields, I still think we have free will and we have control. And the way I would phrase it is, when you go into a restaurant, you don't have the ability to choose whether you like broccoli or not. That's something that wells up. But you do have the ability to choose what you choose off the menu. And so we have the ability to correct for our unconscious weaknesses, including things like tribalism and racism. And we have the ability to really select among the emotional signals that are sent up to us.
Mm-hmm. There are a couple of questions about the realm of spirituality and religion. A surprise on the part of one questioner that religion and spiritual background, faith, community, didn't play more of a role in your description of formation.
Yeah, that's in part because this is an entire separate field. There are about 9 million books now out on the brain and religion. But mostly my reading of this literature and my conversation with these scientists suggested to me that the science that the things we're discovering doesn't really settle the fundamental issues. They give us the mechanism. So, for example, there's a guy named Andrew Newberg at Penn, now at Thomas Jefferson Hospital, who looks at brain scans of monks and nuns who are in the midst of religious ecstasy. And the part of the brain that monitors where our body is at any moment sort of goes dark during those moments. So they lose a sense of awareness of themselves. But that doesn't tell us, that doesn't solve the fundamental issues of whether God exists or not, or what God's role is. It just gives us the mechanism through which religious experiences happen. And it reminds us that we have within our mind facilities to have religious experiences. But that's not really the crucial issues as far as I'm concerned. And to me, the crucial mystery is still the crucial mystery. We have 3 pounds of meat in our head. How does spiritual essence arise? And how do emotional things, which are ethereal, rewire the neurons in the head? That is the essential mystery. And if there's divine creativity, it is in that leap between spirit and material and between material and spirit. And until we solve the problem of how consciousness arises, we're not really solving that essential mystery.
A somewhat related question around character formation and the shaping of our own personal morality. To what extent do you feel that is determined? Is the strain of question of this question?
I think we have the power to build our character, not so much by, as Nancy Reagan would say, just say no. I don't think we have the ability to change our mind just by iron force of will, as the Victorians may have defined character. But I do think we have the ability, as Aristotle would say, to encourage certain habits. And one of the themes of the research is, if you want to change your mind, change your behavior. And your behavior will change your habits. Or as the folks at Alcoholics Anonymous say, fake it till you make it. And by encouraging habit, etiquette, small acts of virtue, you're creating grooves in your mind, grooves in your behavior, which will then help you when the true character tests come along. And so that's one way character is built. I think the second way is institutions, by living within institutions. And I quote in the book, though you can Google this, a speech by Ryan Sandberg, who was second baseman of the Chicago Cubs, when he was elected to the Hall of Fame, the Baseball Hall of Fame. He gave a beautiful speech in which he said, "I just tried to play the game the way the people who came before me wanted it to be played. And I just tried to live up to their example. And so when I hit a double, I hustled all the way to second. When I hit a home run, I didn't celebrate. I just tried to play it the way it had been played by the people before me." And that's an example of institutional thinking. Institutions embody the collected wisdom of people who have come before, and people who are formed by institutions sort of absorb that wisdom in ways they may not be aware of, but they're patterns of behavior.
Mm-hmm. There's a question on whether Americans are ready for emotion. Is your book going to make the world safe for the next generation's Edmund Muskie crying?
Yeah, my partner, Mark Shields, worked for the Muskie campaign, and his joke is he's the one who, you know, he told Ed, "You really should show more emotion. It'd be a good political thing." And I think this is happening to some degree. Now John Boehner cries every 30 seconds. And to be honest, and I don't really talk about this so much because I'm a little hesitant, many of you know the comedian Sacha Baron Cohen. His father, Simon Baron Cohen, is a major figure in this field in London. And he studies the difference between male and female brains. And a lot is the same. IQ is the same. A lot is the same. But I think it certainly is true that women are more capable, do better at tests of other people's emotions. And I do think as we move from a male-dominated world to a more equal world, this sort of stuff is more talkable about, mm-hmm. if I can put it that way. I deal with words for a living. So.
We're here with David Brooks, who deals with words for a living.
Just use the first
the next question is really, what does this field of emotions say about the electorate and about the way they behave?
Right. So we, like every other decision we make, the decision of who to vote for and who to support is both irrational and emotional, and a lot of it happens unconsciously. And so there's research done at Princeton where they gave people two faces of candidates who were running against each other in races far away from where the research was being done. And they gave people a second to look at the research and said, who seems more competent to you of these two faces? And just by giving people a second look, they could predict with 70% accuracy who was going to win that election. And they gave the same test to people in South America and Africa and former Soviet Union, the same faces, and those people could also predict with the same 70% accuracy. In another piece of research, they gave people videos of gubernatorial candidates. Again, the people knew nothing about these candidates. And in some of the videos, the volume was turned on, and people were not good at predicting who was going to win when the volume was on. But when the volume was turned off, they were very good at predicting. And so we have the facility to just look at people and say, who's competent? And that's not a stupid thing, because this is what we do all day. We look at each other and say, who's competent? Who inspires trust? The second thing has to do with political partisanship. And many people, or at least there's this myth, though I'm not sure anybody actually believes it, that we form our views and our party affiliations by looking at the new different policy proposals, healthcare reform, tax reform, and we choose the party with the best reform proposals. I've never actually met anybody who chose their parties this way, but there's a body of research that says we either inherit our party affiliation from our parents or we select it when we're in our 20s, and basically we select it on the basis of social identity, which party is filled with people like ourselves. And then after you've picked the party identity, then you get the philosophy. So you decide you're a Democrat, and then you become more friendly to the welfare state. You decide you're a Republican, and then you become friendlier to the free market. And that philosophy follows identity chronologically. And I do think this is how people pick their parties.
There's a question about homeschooling. And with your interest in education, what does homeschooling do in terms of these underlying subconscious developments?
Yeah, well, most of the kids I know who've homeschooled, the families who have done it, it's not solitary. There are some things that are solitary where it's a parent and a child, but often there's a lot of group dynamics, and they have common theater, common athletics. There's a lot of group activities within homeschooling. I guess the two things I'll say first is that to raise a kid who's prepared for the world, the Mandarin flashcards and the Mozart for Babies minds, that doesn't work. All you have to do is be good enough. There's a scientist at the University of Virginia, a psychologist named Eric Turkheimer, who emphasizes this. Once you get above a certain level, a certain threshold of having a healthy relationship with your kids, all the extra Mozart for Babies minds is doing nothing. Just establish good rapport, good relationships, so they know how to build relationships. And so you don't have to be super parent. You just have to be good enough. And if homeschooling parents are doing that, I think that's good enough. The second thing, and this is in relationship to the Tiger Mom, Amy Chua, who said that, you know, she forced her kids to get straight A's and to do all the piano and violin lessons, but she didn't allow them to go on sleepovers. And based on this research, I wrote a column saying, you know, if you just look objectively at what is cognitively demanding, getting straight A's is sort of demanding. Playing a Mozart piece is cognitively demanding. But something that is tremendously demanding is going on a sleepover with 14-year-olds. Because our mind is built to socially process each other. And being around 14-year-old girls, if you're a 14-year-old girl, I'm saying this theoretically, not from personal experience, but at a sleepover is probably you're negotiating phenomenally complicated social networks. I wrote this in my column, and Stephen Colbert had my head on the body of a 14-year-old girl having a pillow fight. So I reemphasize that I've never actually been at a sleepover with 14-year-old girls.
We're here with David Brooks, the New York Times columnist. There are a couple of questions about the use of emotions by politicians, and this will pre-tell some of the political questions that are to come here. But as you might imagine, it being Palo Alto, one of the questions is very neutral and says, what about politicians who use deliberately emotions of fear as a part of their appeal? The other one says, what about those Republicans who use emotions of fear?
Yeah. Well, let me emphasize a distinction that I think, first, I would say in general, in 50 years, I have the suspicion that the word emotion will be gone from our vocabulary because we use it to describe many different things in many different forms. But one of the things we allied is the distinction between arousal and emotion. And so emotion is the way you can subtly value things and read things. Arousal is the heat of your response. And so actually, speaking of Stephen Colbert, I was on his show 2 weeks ago, and he said, I love your book because it means I don't have to think. And my response was, you're confusing emotion with horniness. That being aroused and having a hot emotion is not the same as having emotion. And so one of the things politicians do and talk show hosts do is they try to keep the arousal high. But arousal is not the same thing as emotional. Having supple and sophisticated emotions and emotional readings and emotional valuations is usually antithetical to high arousal. And so the difference is between just having a crude, highly aroused emotion and usually artificial in the case of talk show hosts and politicians who express outrage when they're not really outraged, is different from someone who has educated their emotion by reading novels, by reading poetry, by looking at art, by listening to music, and has a supple repertoire of emotional valuations. And so I would say that politicians often manufacture arousal to build loyalty and to enforce community or teamism, but that doesn't mean they're being intelligently emotional.
Before we leave the book, that you've got to expect a question. How much of your autobiography is in Harold?
There are bits and pieces, but the characters, I describe this is not a novel, but it is an allegory. So a novelist, when they create characters, they make them idiosyncratic and very vibrant and very unique. But the characters in this book exist simply to illustrate the trends in the research. So far from being idiosyncratic, the characters are meant to be quintessential. And so most of what they do is to illustrate some piece of research or some phenomenon I read about in the research. So there are certain superficial things that I threw in from my own life that I just found amusing visits to Aspen, Colorado, and things like that. But in general, the characters are there exemplifying the research, mostly because I didn't become a professor because I don't think abstractly very well. I became a journalist because I need concrete examples to help me remember things. And so I created the characters in part to give me concrete examples or of how these phenomena that the researchers are finding play out in sort of more or less real situations.
So one person asks, this is not going to get in the way of your political commentary. Is it sharing so much of your touchy-feely emotional side in the book?
I don't think so. I mean, it hasn't made me reach over and kiss Mark Shields on the cheek or anything like that. My wife, actually, we were in the car just a couple weekends ago. We were out walking the dog, and I got in the car earlier to set the GPS system. And she was angry at me, and she got in the car and said, okay, Mr. Touchy-Feely, what am I feeling right now? You're the big scholar of all this. And I said, you're pissed off at me. And she said, you're right, you're right. but I will say there are a couple things that it has changed my view of things. The main one is that I think we've had two very individualistic revolutions in our lifetime, the 60s, which was about personal and cultural liberation, and the 80s, which was more about economic liberation. And so over the past 40 years, we've done very well by the individual and celebrated individual freedom. I think we've done less well or paid less attention to communal bonds. And I think this work really reemphasizes the importance of communal bonds and evaluating the importance of the quality of relationships, the space between people, which we're not that great at thinking about.
There was a question here about genetics, and will there be a new book that you'll write 10 years from now on what genetics teaches us about how we are driven in life, that is either separate from or dominant to the emotional?
Yeah, no, and I thought there'd be more genetics in the book, but as I read more and met more behavioral geneticists, I think they faced this phenomenon maybe 10 years ago. They thought they could link a gene to a behavior. But as they've gotten into the field, they've noticed that it's not one gene that creates a behavior. It's 100 genes interacting with an infinity of possible circumstances that create a behavior. And so it's much more complicated than they thought it was. And in many of these spheres, you find the same learning curve. They think they're about to solve some problem, and then they reach a point where they realize it's way more complicated than they thought, so they're down here again, and they've got a much steeper hill to climb. And I was at NIH at a different time a few weeks ago, and I often ask people, what's the big thing you've taken away from your work? And one of the behavioral people said, I thought we were going to understand this in my lifetime, and I no longer think that.
Mm-hmm. Question about your political views and how you characterize yourself. What position do you feel you play on the NewsHour in the Friday night commentary?
Yeah.
What is your political position that you
right. Well, we get labeled left and right, but I think I'm a specific sort of conservative. I'm half Edmund Burke, and Burke mentioned this concept of epistemological modesty. The world is more complicated than we can know. We should be modest about our awareness of planning. And then that's married in an American context with my other sort of hero is Alexander Hamilton, who, if some liberals believe in using government to enhance equality and some conservatives believe in limited government to enhance freedom, the Hamiltonian tradition believes in limited but energetic government to enhance social mobility. And so the Hamilton tradition led to the Whig Party, led to the Republican Party under Lincoln, led to Teddy Roosevelt. And now there are about six Hamiltonians in the country, of which I'm one. But I do think I try to be an heir to that tradition. So Hamilton and Burke, if you marry those two, you've pretty much explained what I'm thinking.
There are questions about both Obama and new candidates for the Republican Party. You've expressed disappointment in Obama more in the last year than you did early on. Is that still your view? Do you think he's lost it?
Well, I have not diminished my admiration for him personally. I spent a lot of time, sometimes talking to him, but a lot of the time talking to people who work around him. And whether you agree or not, I do think he generally is a very serious person, a very talented person, who's conducting himself in the way, in the honest way one would want a president to conduct himself. I have been more disappointed recently. In part, I didn't like the health care bill, but I sort of understood why he would do it. I think it was a disaster not to control costs. But I do think the debt in particular is a central moral challenge facing the country. And I've heard him personally, and I've heard people around him constantly promise me, really starting in, say, 2006, that they're about to really do something fundamental and serious to put this country on a sustainable fiscal path. And it's always next year. And I thought this was the year would be the year, not next year. And I really think when he had the Simpson-Bowles Commission, that was an opportunity to really embrace that commission. And not every aspect, but embrace the conversation they started where we really talked seriously about reorganizing the government to make it sustainable. And I thought the decision to have a budget that really punted on all that was a shame. And I'm still hopeful he'll seize the mantle and really lead a serious discussion. But I guess I no longer think it's going to happen before the next election. And so we'll have wasted a couple of years, even though there are now 64 senators who want to have that discussion, have signed up for it. And so I'm disappointed in that. And so I'm disappointed in him, but, just politically as a prognosticator, he's still the most talented politician in the country, and I would not bet against him winning re-election.
Are you still as enthused about the Indiana governor that you wrote the column about a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, no, I like Mitch Daniels. I think he'd be the strongest Republican candidate. He's 5'6", low to the ground, in touch with the people. and I just think, I think what the country wants is, among other things, a good manager. He is a very good manager. He really cares about that stuff and throws out data and management improvements. And I do think he's fundamentally honest about the fiscal challenges facing the country. And if he runs, I think he would run a serious campaign where he'd say, we'd just hold up charts and say, here's the debt. Here's the amount that entitlements are contributing to the debt. If we're going to deal with this problem, here's what we got to touch and lay it out in front of you. And it doesn't take a genius to lay it out. Then it's not a partisan thing. Everybody agrees on what the problem is. And I think he'd run that kind of campaign, and we'd finally get to see if the American people are willing to really face the consequences of their decisions.
And a one-word answer will do for this one. You appear on PBS and NPR frequently. Is NPR a biased network?
I don't have a one-word answer, but I have a shortish answer, which is that I have a test. I drive home listening to All Things Considered, and I turn on NPR, and I turn it off whenever I think something seems too NPR-ish for me. And sometimes it's when I think it's just biased reporting. And sometimes when sometimes NPR treats the entire world like it's Burlington, Vermont. And so sort of the 20-minute lesbian dance troupe in Manitoba, that report. And so I would measure the bias by how often I just get the urge to turn the channel. And I would say 10, 15 years ago, if my drive home was half an hour, I would turn it away probably two or three times. And now I find I can go all the way home without turning it off. And either I've changed or they've changed. But I think they've changed. I think they've done a much better job in the last 10 years of being aware that there are parts of the country that are not Burlington, Vermont, but are actually regular old America. So I think they've made progress.
Thank you very much, David.
Thank you.
I hope you have all enjoyed this evening's program, brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank David Brooks, New York Times columnist and author of The Social Animal, A Story of Love, Character, and Achievement. Also, Kirk Hansen, Executive Director of the Markela Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this evening's of the Commonwealth Club celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion is adjourned.